May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Bernard and Francis Sykes as next friends of Lori Beth Sykes, a minor. Petitioners were the plaintiffs in the trial court. The defendant there was Dr. T.P. Butler, pediatric surgeon. This is a medical malpractice case in which the trial court granted summary judgment in favor of Dr. Butler, and that summary judgment was affirmed by the Texarkana Court of Appeals. The issues involved in this appeal concern the constitutionality of a statute passed by the legislature in 1975, which absolutely prohibits a child's suit against a doctor or hospital unless it's filed within 2 years from the date of the tort, whether the minor knew about the cause or not. We say that this statute, Article 5.84 of the Insurance Code, which has now been repealed, violates both the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the Texas and the United States Constitution. This particular statute, Article 5.82, totally obliterates the traditional rule in tort litigation that a minor or other person under disability has until age 18 or until the disability is removed, has until that time to file a suit. Now we say this particular statute is unconstitutional because it fails any and all standards of review that this court might choose to adopt. It fails the strict scrutiny test, it fails the rational relation test, it fails the intermediate scrutiny test, and then last but not least, we rely on three opinions of this court in Middleton against Texas Power and Light, Lebone versus City of Galveston, and Waits against Sondock, wherein this court, we say, adopted a standard of constitutional review wherein if the statute is unreasonable or arbitrary, this court has the authority and the mandate, indeed, to set aside that particular statute. So we submit to the court that whatever test you choose to use in examining this particular statute, that Article 5.82 falls or fails all of these tests. Now, the respondent, Dr. Butler, would have you believe that all you have to do is simply examine whether or not there is a suspect class and whether or not the legislature had a right to examine the topic of insurance rates, which supposedly this particular statute was designed to remedy. And then, sort of out of their medico-legal computer, just presto, there is no constitutional problem. We submit to the court that the answer is not that easy, especially when the rights of children are involved and the rights to protect a fundamental right that's guaranteed by the Texas Constitution, the right to be free from injury to the person, is guaranteed in this state by Article 1, Section 13. So we do have a fundamental right involved, a fundamental right not only of the child, but also a fundamental right to be free from injury. So when the case is put in that light, we submit to the court that a strict test is required to examine the rationale or the reasons, if any, behind the legislature's action. This particular statute, we also submit, is unconstitutional on its face since it discriminates against tort victims in the medical malpractice area as compared with tort victims in any other endeavor. For example, why is it that a child who might be harmed in a hospital by a medical appliance, for example, if there's some failure of a piece of equipment in the operating room, why should that child be entitled to have a full recovery and wait until age 18 to litigate that particular cause of action, yet in the same hospital, in the same operating room, a child who is harmed by a nurse or a physician is confined to 2 years whether they know there's injury or not? So we submit that just looking at this statute on its face, it's unconstitutional. Now, as this court knows, there's been literally a ream of amicus briefs filed that go to the question concerning the legislative history behind this particular statute. And all of the amicus briefs filed in favor of Dr. Butler argue that, well, there was this great medical malpractice insurance crisis that the legislature had to deal with, and that the state has a compelling interest to have stabilized insurance rates and a stabilized insurance system. Well, we submit that the state does have a legitimate inquiry in that particular area of the law. Yet, not one of the briefs, not one line of the legislative history indicates that that problem is going to be solved by shifting the cost to innocent minor tort victims who are harmed by physicians or hospitals. There is not one line in the legislative history that even hints that actuarial figures, statistics, or anything like that will be solved by taking the children and limiting their right, which they had, to age 18. So we submit to the court that the rational relation test can also be used and examined in this particular statute, and that when that test is used, the court will see that although there may have been a crisis, the crisis was not one that was going to be remedied by limiting the rights of minor tort victims. And furthermore, we submit to the court that the crisis, if indeed there was one that was brought about by the fact that malpractice insurance rates went regulated in this state from 1955 to 1975, and that may have been the real reason behind the increase in rates. And there is ample legislative history to support that, which we have cited in our brief as well. The United States Supreme Court has dealt with the rights of minor children on numerous occasions in a series of cases out of the state of Louisiana dealing with the right of children, illegitimate children, in workers' compensation areas, in the area of tort law. The Supreme Court has jealously protected those particular rights. And also in the case arising out of Texas in San Antonio Independent School District against Rodriguez, the court pointed out that when you have a class of citizens who are saddled with disabilities such that they are relegated to a position of political powerlessness, that in that instance, in those type cases, the U.S. Supreme Court will apply this particular strict test, and that in the area of sensitive and personal rights, the Supreme Court will exercise and use the strict test approach. Just this last term...
When you say strict test, you mean strict scrutiny?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And just this last term, in 1982, in another case arising out of the state of Texas, in Plyler against Doe, concerning the rights of illegal alien children to a free public education, the court noted that legislation directing the onus of a parent's misconduct against the child simply does not comport with the fundamental conceptions of justice. And in this particular case, the only crime or fault or mistake, quite frankly, that Bernard and Francis Sachs made was not timely filing the case within the 2-year period. Now, in every other area of law in this state, we do not take the parent's misconduct and visit it upon the child. As a matter of fact, as this court knows, a guardian ad litem, or next friend, or another person in charge of a child's business cannot waive any of the rights, any of the substantial rights of the child. So we submit that what this statute does, it in effect it punishes a child for the misconduct of the parent or guardian or other person that may be in charge of the child's business. As the court will recall, In 1913, the legislature passed the workers' compensation law. And that law was challenged in this court and in the United States Supreme Court as being a denial of equal protection and due process, as taking away the right of an employer to certain defenses. And this court held that although an employer may not have a vested interest in a particular type of defense, that the legislature had not totally abrogated the employer's rights. That what the legislature had done was simply substitute another method or another means for that right. In other words, there was a quid pro quo, if you will. And this is an analysis that this court has used on several occasions, in the Middleton case, and in Lebone versus City of Galveston, and Waits against Sondop, that if the legislature chooses to act in an area involving fundamental liberties where immediate harm can result, then it must have some substitute. There must be something in place of the right that's taken away. In this particular case, in Article 5.82, the legislature offered no substitute. In other words, this is an absolute statute for the two-year period, and there's been no substitute, no alternative remedy that the minor can rely on. Now, you know, we could spend a lot of time talking about all of the tests concerning equal protection and due process, but really, what we're talking about in this case is whether or not we're going to allow the legislature to shift the cost of a particular tort or harm to the innocent tort victims. And we submit to the court that when this statute is examined in that light, that it is clearly unconstitutional. There simply is no reason, no justification for doing that when other alternative remedies indeed exist. Just to give you an example of what we think is the absurdity of this statute, I submit to this court that there is a crisis, for example, in the judicial system in this state, right at this very moment. Our courts are overcrowded, the dockets are very long, it takes a long time to get cases tried, to get them disposed of, and the legislature could easily find that there is a crisis. Now, how do they go about solving that crisis? Well, there are some parameters, there are confines. For example, the legislature could wave its magic wand and say, well, since most of the litigants in this state are over the age of 30 years, we're going to prohibit all causes of action for tort or contract by persons over the age of 30. Now, that would alleviate the crisis, all right. That would reduce the court's docket. And it would be very efficient, very simple. Obviously, it would abridge and take away the rights of citizens to pursue the remedies for which they are entitled to be compensated. And that access and that remedy, of course, is guaranteed by the Constitution. Just as we say that the right and remedy of Lori Beth Sachs is guaranteed as well, and that she rightfully should have until age 18 to pursue any cause of action against the doctor or hospital. We say if the court upholds this particular statute, that we will simply be punishing Lori Beth Sachs for the misconduct of her parents, and we'll be allowing the legislature to shift the cost to the persons who are the least likely to be able to bear the cost, namely those of the innocent tort victims. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, John H. Martin will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, I will present argument this morning on behalf of Dr. Ted Votler, who is a pediatric surgeon practicing in the Dallas area. One of the most ironic things to me about this case is the fact that we have something of a reversal of roles here. For years, this court has, and I must say properly so, abolished certain doctrines of law that were anachronistic, fictitious, ancient creatures of the common law and statute. Here, for once, I find that instead of the defendants using such doctrines of law, the plaintiff's bar is using a doctrine of law, because when you really think about it, in 1983, it is purely a fiction that a minor lacks the ability to discover, to use Mr. Collins' word, an injury that has happened to the minor. That overlooks the fact that a minor does have parents. It overlooks the fact that a minor is protected by its parents. And certainly on the facts of this case, where you've got a minor with parents, with a mother and father, there is no question of discovery. So I think it's important for the court to keep that in perspective, and also to keep in perspective the fact that what we've got here is not a statute that somehow granted a special privilege or a special right to the medical profession, the healthcare profession, but instead withdrew a special privilege that the legislature, in its grace, back as far as 1913, had granted to minors. Now, that legislative special privilege that has been granted to minors never has applied in all areas, workers' comp being an example. But I think it's important to remember that that was a statutorily, not constitutionally, but a statutorily granted privilege to minors. The legislature certainly has changed that in many ways over the years. The foremost example, of course, has been the lowering of the age of majority in this state. There's talk now about increasing the drinking age. So the legislature over the years has adjusted that age to fit particular situations, and that's all they've done here. They've taken a special privilege that was given to a class of people and taken it away. And another thing that I think fits in here that I think is very important, and as is discussed in the numerous pages of briefing materials which this court has before you, not all states over the years have even seen fit to grant the special privilege, the special disability to minors. There is much talk in Mr. Collins' argument and in briefs filed by all parties about the question of discovery, the so-called court-created discovery rule, which has been in the past before the enactment of Article 5.82 in 1975. The law of this state, but the law of this state only in certain limited contexts. Now, in connection with the discovery rule, the idea of discovery, and I do think that the concept of someone's ability to discover, someone's ability to know that a wrongful act or that an injury has occurred, is an important consideration. But I think it's important for the court in deciding this case to keep in mind that on this particular case, the Sachs family against Dr. Butler, Mr. and Mrs. Sachs do not claim, and have never claimed, that they were unaware of the injury.
Mr. Martin, can a child bring suit in his own name in Texas?
A child brings suit through a minor.
No, can a child on his own bring suit in Texas?
No, through an ex-friend.
All right, and let's assume that as in the case here at Barr, the parents had knowledge within 2 years of the act of malpractice, which is the case, is it not?
Yes, sir.
Can this young child sue her parents for their failure to bring suit within 2 years?
No, I don't believe so.
Then what remedy does the child have?
At this point, the child has no remedy.
You think that's constitutionally permissible?
I do believe it's constitutionally permissible. The other point that I would make at this point, there is no allegation of any kind of failure to discover. There is no any allegation of fraudulent concealment in this case. There's a lot of discussion in the briefs about those facts, about what if we have a situation where a minor or the minor's parents is unaware of the injury. That's not what we have here. The discovery rule has never, either in this state or anywhere else, been a rule of law that is ordained or sanctioned by any provision of the United States Constitution. Some states have never had the discovery rule applied to any cause of action, including malpractice cases. There have been, I think, one of the most graphic examples that demonstrates that the discovery rule is not a creature of constitutional law is the case out of New York involving a latent disease, asbestosis, where, as the court's probably aware, the exposure to the injurious substance frequently occurs 20 or 30 years before any disease is manifest. The courts in New York have held that if suit is not brought within two years or whatever the statute is up there from the last period of exposure to the injurious substance, that the plaintiff is barred from any recovery at all. And the courts in New York have held that this does not violate any constitutional provision. And the case that's cited in the brief, certiorari was denied by the United States Supreme Court. So I think it's very clear that the discovery rule, the inability of someone to discover their injury, is not a rule of constitutional dimensions. It's a court-created rule. Now, this court has written on the discovery rule in Robinson versus Weaver as recently as 1977, and I think that case demonstrates that this court did not feel that the discovery rule had any kind of constitutional impact, because this court wrote in that case that it only applied to a certain limited class of cases, namely cases where there was some sort of actual physical evidence that could be looked to, and did not apply to misdiagnosis cases, a case that just involved an error of judgment on the part of a physician. And the policy justification that this court used in that opinion was that it was, after the passage of time, unfair to have to go back and try to second guess something when there was no physical evidence available. I would also submit to the court, talking about the discovery rule, that from the standpoint of constitutional law, there is no difference between an adult who is unable to discover his injury and a child who is unable to discover his injury. And to me, that also is just graphic evidence that the discovery rule, the fact that someone does not or cannot discover, is not a rule approaching constitutional dimensions. Now, the primary...
Doesn't this discovery rule relate to a point of error that wasn't granted, the open courts concept of the Constitution?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it does, because I think it pertains to that point, yes, but I think it also pertains very much to the equal protection and due process arguments that they have raised, because they argue frequently in the briefs that have been filed that this is unfair, it deprives due process, it deprives someone of equal protection of the laws, because it is possible that on a certain set of facts, a minor might not be able to discover their injury. A minor might not know about the injury and might not know of the legal remedies available to them. I think that ignores the fact that minors do have parents that are legally responsible for protecting their children.
So you're saying we can consider the discovery concept within the equal protection and due process points?
Certainly, I think it's a concept that the court should consider. The point I'm attempting to make is that I don't believe the discovery rule is a rule of law that's constitutionally mandated. I think the discovery rule, as it has existed in this state, has always been in very limited context. It was limited by this court in 1977, and I don't think it is a rule having constitutional dimensions to it. It should be a court-created rule. Now, Mr. Collins, in his argument a few moments ago, referred to the various tests under the Equal Protection Doctrine. In the briefs that have been filed with the court, and as the Court of Appeals in this case correctly pointed out, the parties are basically in agreement that the proper test is not the strict scrutiny test, but rather the rational basis test. Mr. Collins also made reference to the so-called intermediate test, and I would submit to the court that in the Fifth Circuit case, the Arsenault case, Arsenault versus Treen, I believe it is, the Fifth Circuit has now specifically held that there is no intermediate level of scrutiny in the equal protection analysis.
That's not true in Mills versus Havlicek. That was clearly a middle-tier test, was it not?
No,
substantial relationship?
That's not, not the way I read it at all, Judge.
Well, doesn't Justice Rehnquist talk about substantial relationship in Mills versus Havlicek?
Well, as I read the Mills case, that, of course, involves illegitimate children. And the Supreme Court...
And a one-year limitation.
Right. The Supreme Court, on several occasions, has written that illegitimacy is a suspect classification. Illegitimate children is a suspect classification.
Well, if it's suspect, then it's strict scrutiny, isn't it?
That's right.
Are you saying there are only two tests?
Yes, sir.
One rational and the other strict scrutiny?
That's right.
And there's no such thing as a middle tier?
That's right.
What is substantial relationship then, as opposed to rational relationship?
Well, I'm not aware of any such thing as a substantial relationship test. I believe there are two tests, the rational basis test and the strict scrutiny test. The strict scrutiny test requires that there be fundamental rights involved, or alternatively that there be a suspect classification involved. And if there is either of those involved, then the court must give strict scrutiny and find a substantial relationship. The rational basis test, which I believe applies to this case, and which in the briefs that have been filed, the parties have agreed is the proper test applied to this case, requires that the legislation bear a reasonable relationship to a proper legislative goal. Of course, it is well settled in this state and under federal constitutional law that a statute will be presumed to be constitutional, absent a showing of something that indicates very convincingly that the legislation was enacted without there being any reasonable relationship to a proper legislative goal.
Do you think that an 11-year-old should realize that she had lost her right fallopian tube?
Well, I think an 11-year-old certainly has the ability to understand that if her parents or the doctor told her about it, but certainly her parents had the ability to understand that and the ability to protect her right, because that's what they saw fit to do.
That's right, but if they don't protect her right by bringing suit as next friend, then she is cut off forever, isn't she?
If the parents do not bring the suit on behalf of their daughter, if the parents do not properly take care of their child, under this statute, the child would be cut off from any kind of life.
Well, I think that's what's bothering the court, and that's what the Court of Appeals said. They said, well, you don't really cut off her rights, you just limit the time in which she can exercise her rights. But the truth of the matter is, her rights are cut off because she can't bring the suit on her own, and she can't sue her parents.
But the right is cut off if her parents don't take care of her. But I just think it's unreasonable in this day and age to assume that parents aren't going to properly take care of the children. And if they don't, then I think that's the problem that the family has got to bear, rather than the medical profession, being exposed to claims as much as 20 years down the road, which is what you had before the statute was enacted. And contrary to what Mr. Collins said, the legislative history, and I won't even attempt to begin to summarize that, the brief that has been filed on behalf of the Texas Medical Liability Trust and the Texas Joint Underwriting Association by Mr. Barber and Mr. Pickens discusses in great detail and much better than I could in the short time I have here to argue this morning the legislative history of this statute. But there is very definitely clear and convincing evidence that from an insurance actuarial standpoint, liability insurance rates could and in fact have been lowered by cutting off what's called the long tail of minority. The child who at age 19, shortly before turning age 20, files a lawsuit as a result of something that allegedly happened at the time he was born. And the evidence in the legislative history is convincing that this was a very serious problem and had a very serious and harmful impact on liability insurance rates for the healthcare profession, and a very serious impact on healthcare costs for the citizens of the state. So I think the legislature has made a very reasonable and rational judgment in placing a very reasonable outside limitation on when a child has to bring a lawsuit. And of course, it's not strictly 2 years, although in this case, the child only had 2 years because she was over six. But under Article 5.82, the child has until age six plus 2 years, or if the child is over six, 2 years from the date of medical treatment.
What is so magic about the age eight? Is it, is a child at the age of eight that much brighter than a child at age of seven? I mean, where does this figure eight come from? It just fall out of the sky? Or like Hera, did it spring from the brow of Zeus, or what?
Judge, I think in the discussion of the legislative history, it's pointed out that from an actuarial standpoint, the actuaries that testified before the legislature felt that an outside limit needed to be put on this, and that 20 years was too long. The figure eight, I'm sure, was reached as a compromise between a strict two-year limitation period.
There's nothing magic then about the figure eight.
I don't think so. And the Article 4590I, the 1977 Texas Medical Liability Insurance Improvement Act, which is the statute that repealed and replaced the statute that's before this court, and 4590I, of course, is the statute that's in effect today, has a different age requirement, and in that it's 12 plus 2 years.
Now, you say this is if we apply any standard, we ought to apply a rational relationship standard here. Isn't that test whether or not the legislation is rationally related to a legitimate state interest?
That's right.
How can depriving, as you admit, you concede, the child has no remedy if the parents don't file suit, how can depriving a child of a right be rationally related to the achievement of any legitimate state interest?
The child is not deprived of a right, assuming the parents
exercise their parental
obligations to the child.
But you can see if the parents don't do it, the child's rights gone out the window.
If the parents do not do it within the two-year period, and the child doesn't turn 18, if you have an older child, obviously, that'd be different. But if you have a child of the age of Laurie Beth Sack, and if the parents do not live up to their parental responsibilities to the children, after a two-year period when medical treatment elapses, that child has no tort cause of action.
Right, and my question to you, what is the rational relationship to any legitimate state interest in this particular legislation to cut off a child from his rights?
The state interest is holding down health care costs and holding down the cost of liability insurance for health care providers. Certainly.
Well, that's true, then why don't we cut off children's right to sue for automobile accidents? I mean, if we want to hold down insurance costs, the liability insurance is increasing, isn't it?
There's a very interesting chart on that very point in the brief that was filed on behalf of the Texas Medical Liability Trust, and it shows statistically that this has never been a problem in the automobile accident area. But it is a serious problem and has a serious impact on liability insurance rates in the field of health care.
Were these figures on insurance, are they nationwide figures, or are they related solely to Texas?
The figures I'm talking about, I don't know. I'd have to go look and see.
Isn't it true that if there was a crisis in malpractice, that it was nationwide and we never had a crisis here in Texas?
Well, I certainly don't agree with that. I think we did have a crisis in Texas. Certainly there was a national crisis, as evidenced by the fact that many, many, many state legislatures believed that there was a crisis and enacted similar legislation to this. And I might add that the courts in other states have considered constitutional points on these other statutes. In a supplemental brief which I filed last week, I attempted to discuss all of the cases that we could find from other jurisdictions dealing with any aspect of constitutionality of the statute of limitations portion of medical malpractice legislation. There have been some general statements made in some of the plaintiff's briefs that have been filed that such and such a statute has been declared unconstitutional. And I think in considering the cases from other states, the court must look very clearly at the case to see whether the statute was struck in its entirety or whether only a limited part of it was, because I would submit to you that there has not been a case from any other jurisdiction which has ever held that a shortened statute of limitations, such as we have here, violates the federal constitution. There have been two cases dealing with minors from other jurisdictions which have held such statutes to be constitutional, and that's the Ritter case out of Alabama and the Rohrabaugh case, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, by the Supreme Court of Indiana. Those statutes, particularly the Indiana statute, are similar, although not identical, to the statute that we have here. Both of those cases considered this question and arrived at the conclusion that this type of legislation does not violate the United States Constitution. Now, some reliance has been placed by the plaintiffs, particularly the amicus brief filed by Mr. Jamail, on the Carson case written by the New Hampshire court. But I would submit to you that the Carson case actually supports our side of this case to a greater extent than it supports the plaintiff's side of this case. The Carson case did involve a statute that the New Hampshire legislature enacted which shortened the statute of limitations as applied to minors. But first of all, the New Hampshire court started off by holding that the right to recover for personal injuries is not a fundamental right guaranteed by the United States Constitution. That's where they start. They go on to say that the classification that you're looking at, whether you're looking on the classification on the plaintiff's side, that is minors, or classifications on the defense side, that is the class of health care providers, that under neither condition was that a suspect classification. That court therefore concluded that the proper standard under federal constitutional law would be the rational basis test. The court then concluded that that it could not and would not find that the New Hampshire legislation violated the federal constitution. But instead, they found that under the New Hampshire constitution and some cases under the New Hampshire constitution, that the New Hampshire constitution guarantees more and greater rights to its citizens than does the United States Constitution. And then they went on to find that the statute did violate not the federal constitution, but the New Hampshire Constitution. The important thing there is that before the enactment of the legislation in the state of New Hampshire, the discovery rule applied to all types of medical malpractice cases. Before the enactment of 5.82 in Texas, the discovery rule never applied to all types of medical malpractice cases, and certainly this court made that abundantly clear in its opinion in Robinson against Weaver. So I would submit to you that the Carson case actually stands for the proposition that such legislation is constitutional under the United States Constitution. Now, under the rational basis test, I submit to the court that the legislation does bear a reasonable and rational relationship to a proper goal of the legislature, namely to hold down liability insurance rates by eliminating the long tail of liability. And I would submit to the court that it is not fair for a doctor, or more likely in many cases a doctor's estate, to be subjected to a lawsuit 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 years after the events complained of. The witnesses are gone frequently, the records are gone frequently, and frequently the doctor is gone. We're looking at a lawsuit against the doctor's estate. And I would submit to you that the legislature has acted reasonably and fairly in shortening this statute of limitations and in removing the special privilege granted to minors, in removing the disability in certain cases after the age of six. As discussed in several of the briefs, and again particularly the amicus brief filed by the Texas Medical Liability Trust, I think it's important to recognize that this type of insurance normally is written in an occurrence type policy, and that is that the policy in force is and the policy that is used is the one that was in effect at the time of the occurrence. So if a doctor gets sued over something that happened 15 years ago, he's got to go back to the policy that was in effect back then, and that sometimes creates problems too from the standpoint of coverage limits and so forth. So I would submit to the court that this legislation bears a very reasonable and rational relation to a proper legislative goal. The due process argument has kind of gotten the back seat in the briefs that have been filed, and I think rightly so. I think that is the less substantial of the two arguments advanced by the plaintiff. The legislature has provided for a reasonable period of time in which to bring a lawsuit in 2 years. And unless this court were to revive the discredited doctrine of substantive due process, that is the only inquiry that the court can really make, is whether 2 years is a reasonable period of time. And certainly since that's the general statute of limitations in this state, I think the court must hold that 2 years is a reasonable period of time in which to bring a lawsuit. The plaintiffs before this court are asking the Supreme Court of Texas to, first of all, do what no other court in the United States has done. In so doing, they are relying on the idea that somehow these people were not able to discover their injury, when in fact the parents certainly were aware of it. I would submit to the court that the issue is not whether any of us sitting here in this room happen to like this particular piece of legislation, whether we think it's a good law, whether we think the legislature made the right decision in enacting it, but rather whether it somehow violates the Constitution either of the United States or the state of Texas. And I would submit to the court that whether you like the legislation or not, it is constitutional. The discovery rule is not a problem of constitutional magnitude. There are many other examples of modified change statutes of limitations which have been upheld by the courts. Workers' compensation laws being a foremost example, the Guest statute, the Fair Reeves doctrine by the United States Supreme Court, wherein a minor whose father is killed in an Air Force accident flying Air Force F-111 has no right of recovery against the U.S. government or the United States Air Force, even if that accident was proximately caused by the negligence of an Air Force mechanic. A minor under those circumstances has no right of tort recovery at all against the United States government. Certainly any area of sovereign immunity or governmental immunity. And finally, in a fairly recent opinion and decided in the supplemental brief I filed last week, one of the courts of appeals of our state has upheld the constitutionality against virtually the same challenges of Article 5536A, dealing with architects, engineers, and builders, in which all citizens have been given a period of time in which to institute suit whether the problem is discovered or not. And this court NRE'd that case, and rightly so. I submit to you that the legislation in question passes all constitutional muster, and this court should affirm judgment of the courts below. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear the response by the petitioner.
Okay, please, the court. Mr. Joe DeMail will present closing argument for the petitioner.
Honorable Justices, I want to express my gratitude for your allowing me to file the amicus brief and for permitting me to share the time in this argument. I have never gotten over the fact that I consider it a privilege to appear before this court, and I do so today. What we have today is a question, I believe, of an attempt, if I may, to restrict the tort remedy to a certain class. And usually when this attempt is made, the restriction of a tort remedy, it is to deny full recovery